This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good day, friends. Today we have with us Professor Alan McPherson, an American historian specializing in American, U.S.-Latin American relations. And he's a professor of history at Temple University. He was born in Berkeley, California, but grew up in Quebec, Canada, where he received his bachelor's from the University of Montreal and was later a fellow of the Canadian Social Science and Humanities Research Council. He earned his master's degree in San Francisco State University and his doctorate from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill on a thesis, A Critical Ambience, Anti-Americanism in U.S.-Caribbean Relations. Well, welcome to Community or Chaos. Hopefully we'll have more community. We've had lots of chaos.
Thank you.
Recently.
Great to be here.
Alan, you recently wrote an article indicating that Donald Trump's anger or bellicosity at Venezuela was not unprecedented. Can you talk about that article and why you wrote it?
Right. I mean, I think the article said in some ways it's not, in some ways it is. I mean, obviously, there's been a long history of U.S. military interventions in Latin America. We can count, you know, among the serious ones, at least 40. Some have led to, you know, short-term interventions in, you know, but this is, you know, including landing troops in foreign countries. Some have been longer occupations. Some have been violent in the sense of funneling lots of weapons and other resources to dictators. But, and so Venezuela would certainly fit into that pattern if a war in Venezuela happened. But it's also important to understand that this would be unprecedented in other ways. For instance, there's never been an American war, a landing of a large number of American troops in a large country of Latin America, and not even in any South American country.
Okay, so we'll just have to wait and see what happens, won't we?
We will.
Can you talk about the history of the United States' view of Latin America, beginning with the Monroe Doctrine, which most people listening won't have heard of?
Sure, yeah, I could talk about the Monroe Doctrine. And that was another point of the article that I made, is that people are saying, you know, as recently as a few days in the New York Times, that this is going to be another episode of the Monroe Doctrine, or that Trump is invoked in the Monroe Doctrine. Neither of those is true. The Monroe Doctrine was announced essentially in 1823, a long time ago, 200 years ago, by one of the earlier presidents, James Monroe. And essentially what it said is that the Americas as a whole, North and South, should be insulated as far as possible from European affairs, and vice versa, right? People of the Americas should also not involve themselves in European affairs. The context was the independence of Latin America. More and more countries in Latin America were becoming independent from Spain, from Portugal, And so the Americans thought it wise to say, okay, once they become independent, then they should never be colonies again. At the time, the United States essentially didn't have any power to enforce that kind of thing. It really didn't have much of a navy. And so it was just kind of a statement of principle. And most Latin Americans, of course, agreed with it, right? If they're going to be independent, of course, they want to stay independent. And they were happy that their neighbor to the north would kind of bless their endeavor for independence. It was really nothing more than that for a couple generations. But then eventually it became this sort of aggressive imperialist doctrine in the days of Teddy Roosevelt and, you know, the 50 years maybe after that, where now the Americans were saying, well, we still want the goal of keeping foreign powers out of Latin America, but now we're going to act unilaterally and before that ever happens in order to prevent any foreigners from thinking about intervening in Latin America. And at the time, it meant essentially the Germans, the French, the British. Eventually, by the Cold War, it meant the Soviets. And eventually, there was less and less sort of interest in the Monroe Doctrine that essentially died sometime during the Cold War.
How did... Isn't the Monroe Doctrine a bit like certain passages in the Bible, Christians interpreting exactly as they wish to suit the situation at the time? I'm being a bit unfair.
Yes.
Christianity.
Well, I mean,
but
you're right.
And, for instance, and, national Christians, Christian nationalists.
Right. Yes, some might interpret it as basically, you know, on the right and the left, as the United States deciding to intervene whenever it wants in Latin America. And the Monroe Doctrine never said that. It basically was always about keeping extra hemispheric powers out of the hemispheres. Now, you could certainly decide that, you know, China is too involved in Latin America, and therefore you want to revive the Monroe Doctrine and somehow kick out the Chinese. I'm not sure exactly what that would mean, right? But you know, at least there would be some kind of logic in there. But if you're going to, let's say, attack Venezuela because you say that its president is the head of a, you know, narco organization, leaving aside the fact that whether that's true or not, it's not in any way the Monroe Doctrine. It's just the United States being an imperialist power. That's what that is. And that the Monroe Doctrine is not basically saying the United States can be an imperialist. It's saying the United States, along with any other countries in America, should push out any extra hemispheric powers. That's what it says.
Can you talk about when the United States started to become an imperialist power? I mean, how did we acquire California, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona? It's one third of Mexico, a third of a country. It's like if the Russians acquire a third of Ukraine, which they definitely wish to. Can you talk about
this? Terms of territory, it was a lot more than Ukraine is now. No, that was, and I wouldn't even call that the first time the United States became an imperialist. I mean, you know, there's different ways of seeing this, and different historians might argue differently, but certainly from the very beginning, as soon as the 13 colonies declare themselves a republic, they immediately embark upon westward expansion, which basically means let's increase the size going west. And that's done essentially through settler colonialism. And so it's not overseas imperialism, but you certainly are taking land from other powers, whether it's the French or the Spanish or the British, and you're taking it, and there are people on that land, generally Native Americans, right? They might be a few Frenchmen also. And so you can say that's not imperialism, that's just growth or expansion. But you know, these are just debates over words. Essentially, the United States was behaving as an empire. In fact, Jefferson in 1803, when he acquires Louisiana, the Louisiana Purchase, which is of course much more than Louisiana, he basically calls for an empire for liberty, right? So they are self-consciously using the term empire, and they see it in a positive way because they say the United States is going to be a more, you know, it's going to spread freedom and democracy through taking other people's lands. And so for them, it's an empire for liberty.
It therefore, seems a contradiction in terms to me.
It does, but it's not for them. To them, you know, if the Americans take land, it will increase democracy because they will give that land to small farmers, and small farmers are sort of the lifeblood of a democracy, people who own their own land, so on and so forth. So, you know, I'll admit there's a logic in there, but of course you have to sustain that with reality. But then, of course, what happens eventually is you run up against larger territories with more people in them, more powerful opponents, and then you end up in war, right? You can't just buy all these properties. And so the war of the 1840s against the Mexican War in the 1840s is the one that essentially cuts off, really, it's about a half, the northern half of what was then Mexico, and today is essentially, right, Texas to California. It's a lot of land. And so the United States all of a sudden increases its power.
I understand that was somewhat complicated because there were some people, including Abraham Lincoln, who was in a member of the House of Representatives, opposed it. And it was also had to do with slavery and those who were opposed to slavery and those who wanted to spread slavery and keep a certain number of senators and representatives representing the slave states.
That's exactly right. I mean, there were a lot of Americans who opposed it. I would say not the majority. And in fact, we kind of know that it's, you know, it was always a minority, and it wasn't until the war was well underway. So before the war begins, most Americans are united. Even somebody like Walt Whitman, right, a very sensitive poet, basically says, let's whip the Mexicans. They did us wrong. Let's take their land. But eventually, yeah, there are some who are opposed. They do it for all sorts of reasons. One of them is the fact that if you take this land, some people are going to want to create new states that are essentially slave states, right? Because that is the great crisis of the 1830s and 40s and 50s is, are the new states out west going to be slave states or free states? And there are all sorts of battles over that. Some of these come directly from 1848, which is when the Americans take all of this land from the Mexicans. And obviously some of this land could be slave land. In fact, historians generally agree that after 1848, then you've accelerated the run up to the Civil War, which will begin in 1861, excuse me.
Can you talk briefly about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's good neighbor policy and his reaction when Mexico nationalized their oil fields?
Sure. You know, Roosevelt, I think there's two important things to understand here. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was somebody who was sensitive to the opposition that Latin Americans expressed towards things like the Monroe Doctrine. Right. His cousin, Theodore Roosevelt, was the one who really pushed the Monroe Doctrine into something very aggressive. Let's land lots of troops. Let's control lots of Latin American governments. Franklin Roosevelt was kind of on the receiving that 20, 30 years later, basically saying, OK, now they all hate us. So let's maybe make some deals here. Let's take some of these troops out. Let's make some trade deals. And that essentially was the good neighbor policy, which is to say the United States will now try to treat Latin America the way it treats every other country in the world, which is that we won't interfere in your internal affairs. We'll try to do business with you. We'll invest. We'll buy your stuff. And hopefully once something terrible like World War II happens, we can really count on you to help us against the Germans. And so the good neighbor policy very much worked. Now, in the case of Mexico, there's the different issue, which is that Mexicans have been undergoing their Mexican Revolution since 1910, and it goes until about 1930. Part of that revolution is this sort of very strongly anti-imperialist nationalism, and there's this drive to try to sort of to assert the nation's hold on Mexico's own resources. So they pass a couple of constitutional changes that basically say the people, right, meaning the state, now own the subsoil resources of the country. And of course, under the soil is lots of petroleum. There's a lot of petroleum that's being pumped out of Mexico at this point. One of these constitutional changes comes when Roosevelt is in power. And so you know, that this means essentially that American oil corporations are going to lose a lot of money in Mexico. They're still going to buy the oil, but not going to own it. And so he certainly has to express the dismay of American corporate world towards Lázaro Cárdenas, who is the president of Mexico. Cárdenas says, sorry, we have the right to do this. We have the right to nationalize these corporations and take this land. And Roosevelt actually, you know, stays true to sort of the spirit of the good neighbor, right? There's nothing in the good neighbor that said anything about corporations or expropriations, but the spirit was, we got to respect the nationalism of Latin Americans. And this is clearly an expression of it. And so Roosevelt is smart enough to say, it's better to just sort of let them do this, but they're still going to, you know, sell lots of petroleum to the American corporations. They're going to let us probably, you know, offer them petroleum services, that sort of thing, banking. And so it's good for us to be on good terms with them because they're going to keep on being a highly important exporting country.
That was almost the exception, isn't it? Roosevelt's policy to countries that wanted to control their own resources, as opposed
well,
to
hard
the,
for me to think of a lot of other countries that did assert nationalism, at least during Franklin Roosevelt's reign.
Well, that's what I mean. His attitude was exceptional for America.
That's true, yeah. And I'm pretty sure that the powers that be in Washington and, you know, Texas were not happy with him.
There was a certain Major General Smedley Butler, and he was the person in control of the military in the Caribbean and Central America and other places. He was the head of the Marine Corps. And the Marine Corps, maybe in some ways, was before they had the CIA, so they probably did the job of the CIA. He had unusual feelings about his work toward the end.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm not sure how I feel about Smedley Butler because, I mean, on one hand, you're exactly correct. Early on in his career, he was a Marine's Marine. You know, I mean, he actually tried to join when he was too young. I think he was 14 or something. Lied about his age. I mean, he really, really wanted to be a Marine. He certainly got in as soon as he possibly could. He participated as a young Marine in almost every intervention you can imagine in the 1910s, 1920s, right? Rose up through the ranks. I think he trained the Haitian gendarmerie. And he certainly had this purist attitude for an imperialist. Right. I mean, he didn't think in any way that the United States should be corrupting Latin America. He really felt that, I mean, he was a Quaker and he sort of acted as a Quaker as an imperialist.
Wow. Quaker Marine.
Yeah, exactly. A Quaker Marine, like a very tough person, but also somebody who expected sort of moral perfection from his, you know, his subordinates and his subjects. And so he would always be shocked that, you know, he would find people breaking the law. He's like, how could you possibly do this? And so he treated everybody as if they were his, you know, his subjects in a military base, even though they were just citizens in a foreign country. So he could be really tough. He generally, however, was incorruptible, right? So there are certain things about him to be admired. He was actually the head of police in Philadelphia, where I live. And same thing, he sort of ran up against the corruption of the establishment in Philadelphia during Prohibition, and they hated him for it because he was too pure and too tough, right? People were saying, of course, we have Prohibition as a law, but we're all going to drink anyways. I mean, you don't understand how this actually works. And he was always so shocked. So towards the end of his life, or later on in his career, he basically says he was a gangster for imperialism or something like that. And I see what he means by this, you know, that he was doing the bidding of American corporations. But if you actually look at the details of the things he was doing, and I've written books about this, he never took any orders from corporations, neither did his superiors. They never in any way... You know, I wouldn't say never in any way, but it's pretty rare that corporations were kind of bossing around the Marines or, fixing the priorities of the Marines. Often the Marines were in Latin America because in my mind, they wanted to change the political culture. And that doesn't mean that's not imperialism. It's very much imperialism. But they basically said, we hate the fact that, you know, these people are taking out too much money from banks. They can't pay them back. They end up in these cycles of revolutions. So let's send the Marines down there and end the violence, get them a loan from Wall Street, and then force them to pay back the loan by being responsible with their money. And yeah, of course, that's good for banks and Wall Street on Wall Street, but it's also generally good for American security. And yes, it's good for an American corporation that wants to, you know, buy a plantation in Central America. But I'm not sure that that was the general reasoning for that. I think he had sort of a kind of a change of heart, and also maybe was looking back at his career in a different perspective. Maybe he was influenced by certain thinkers. So he's not necessarily, you know, wrong on the facts, but I think his interpretation was probably skewed at that point. And I think he's been overquoted because he only said that one time in his whole career. The rest of his career, he never said anything about imperialism.
Did he write a book about it?
Yeah, he's written a memoir, maybe two, and there have been books about him. Mm. I can't remember them in great enough detail to tell you exactly what he said in them.
Is there any truth to the fact that he may have stopped a coup from even starting in America, that certain industrialists asked him to lead a coup against Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Yeah, that's sort of still an unsolved history. There were these industrialists. I think they, you know, it does seem that there was a plot, or at least talk of a coup against Roosevelt. I mean, Roosevelt was hated by a lot of industrialists. And apparently part of that plot was to install Butler as the new president. He denounced it. He said he was never told of any kind of plot. He was never at the head of anything like that. And so we don't know, right? He might have been lying, trying to get himself out of jail, out of treason charges. From what I know of him, he wouldn't just simply not do something like that. I mean, he might be very frustrated by Roosevelt in many ways. But this seemed like it would go beyond his character. It's more in his character to say, no, I would never do that, and then denounce the people who are trying to put him at the head of their movement.
Isn't that about what happened? Probably.
Yeah, that's what he said. Yes. Yeah,
so, and Congress took it somewhat seriously.
Well, of course, any rumors of a coup or, right, you know, attempt against the president, you have to take very seriously.
Okay, could you talk about what happened after Roosevelt and after World War II? My thesis would be that after World War II, what they did in Latin America was not unusual. It wasn't a change of policy. Maybe it was more brutal and more often. But it wasn't a big change from what was happening in the Caribbean and Central America, particularly, from the time of Teddy Roosevelt until Franklin Roosevelt.
Right. I mean, I think some things continued, some things were different. The continuation part is that the United States certainly gave itself the right to intervene unilaterally and militarily in Latin America. And so it did so in Cuba, it did so in Guatemala, it did so, in Central America in the 80s, in Grenada in the 80s. What was new, though, Dominican Republic, 1965. What was new, though, was the justification. At this point, the United States is basically saying, we now are defying the Monroe Doctrine as not really keeping the Europeans out, but specifically keeping the Soviets out. And it was really more than that. In 1954 in Guatemala, there really is no evidence that the Soviets in any way are involved in Guatemala in sort of electing this reformist president or keeping him in power. So the Americans actually change their definition of the Monroe Doctrine. And they say, what we want to keep out now isn't just foreign soldiers or foreign influence. It's foreign ideology. So they start including communism as a reason for intervention, as a sufficient reason for intervention.
How about democratic socialism?
Well, that comes later, right? But that's essentially, they don't have those words, but that's what they're thinking of in Guatemala, because they do overthrow democratically elected government. And there it's the United States that does it directly, right? The CIA does it directly. It's helped by a bunch of Central Americans. But then that gets us to another thing that changes in the Cold War, which is that armed with this new sense that we got to do anything we can to keep communism out of Latin America, was the, you know, huge multiplication, the mushrooming of aid to anti-communist dictators. So it didn't really matter what these folks did to their own people. Didn't matter if there was evidence of the Soviets helping or not helping. What they really cared about was communism. And it didn't matter if they were if their opponents were democratically elected, like what happened in Chile in 1973, the Americans would indirectly, right, fight communism by essentially giving lots of loans and guns and so on to these dictators.
I understand in Guatemala that what was in the United Fruit Company lobbied hard, both President Truman and Eisenhower. And one of the things that broke the camel's back was that Guatemala was introducing actually very mild land reform. What they were saying is land that's unused and not being used at all, we'll give this to the peasants. We'll try to make their life a bit easier, give them more land. And at this time, Chaco Banana. What's the name of the banana company now? Chico or?
United Fruit or Chiquito, you mean?
Chiquito. Owned almost all the land in Guatemala. They also owned the port, which they got quite a bit of money in. So there was the anti-communism and the fear of communism, which included any kind of socialism. I mean, they probably wouldn't have liked Denmark in Latin America. But the history of Guatemala was terrifying in some ways, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was talking about when I mentioned this reformist president, right? So there's actually two presidents who are elected, and the second one, Jacobo Arbenz, you know, enacts this land reform. And I'd say it's more than just the last straw, right? It's a massive brick that is breaking the camel's back. It is the thing that Americans absolutely cannot stand. And the reason is that it's targeting large landowners. Some of these are, you know, other Guatemalans and others and so on, but the United Fruit Company is based in Boston. It has a lot of friends in the Eisenhower White House. And you're right, it lobbies the Truman administration, then the Eisenhower administration. And they have to be careful, right, United Fruit Company, because they can't basically say, we want the U.S. government to overthrow this guy because he's kicking us off of our land. And you're right, it's essentially it's unused land. But UFCO doesn't want to lose it, because then other people might grow bananas on it, and that competes with them. So they want to keep the price of bananas up, and therefore they keep a lot of unused land. And they don't want to be expropriated, even though it's legal to expropriate them. So they can't go to Washington and say, this guy wants to expropriate us, we're going to lose a lot of money, take him down. Right, the United States can't sustain that kind of rationale for taking down a sovereign government. So instead, what they say, they actually put an ad out in the New York Times that says why the Kremlin hates bananas. And their case is that, first of all, this Arbenz fellow is a communist. How is he a communist? How do we know he's a communist? Well, because he wants to expropriate us, and that's only communists do that. And on top of it, they basically say, because he's a communist, he must be supported by Moscow. He must be supported by the Kremlin. And there's essentially no evidence for that. I mean, we now know that, you know, Arbenz was kind of a kind of a socialist and maybe thought that one day their socialism would come to Guatemala. He was a real fan of Franklin Roosevelt also. He wanted a New Deal. He wanted a more prosperous country. And he thought by distributing land to poor peasants, they're going to work it and we're going to have a more prosperous country. He did have communist friends, but, you know, they didn't control the government.
Roosevelt had communist friends.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And the Communist Party existed in the United States while it, you know, was banned in most of Latin America. But that's exactly the point, is that the rules were different if you were less powerful, right? And kind of beholden to powerful American corporations. So it doesn't mean that one rationale is wrong and the other is right, right? So often I'll ask my students in college, I'll give them the Guatemala story and I'll say, was it the bananas or the communism that overthrew Arbenz, right? Is it for the money or is it just a fear of communism? And frankly, the correct answer is it's both.
Of course.
Right?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah,
I
even,
mean, it, even in a way, it would have been harder for America to intervene if they hadn't had the fear of communism. If the fear of communism was both because of Russia, but also it was, you had McCarthyism about that time. There was a communist in every socialist heart. There was a communist in every dissenter.
That's right. And so what they really tried to do is get evidence of any kind of help from the other side of the Iron Curtain, right? I mean, at some point, Stalin dies in 1953, and the Congress of Guatemala has a minute of silence, right, for one of the most important leaders of the 20th century. And UFCO points to this and says, aha, evidence of Soviet influence in Guatemala. I mean, that's how desperate they are to find it. But what does happen eventually is that all of the surrounding countries have agreed not to sell weapons to Arbenz. The Americans aren't selling weapons. So he knows pressure is mounting for people to have a coup against him. And he can't buy weapons anywhere. So he actually orders weapons from behind the Iron Curtain, I think from the Czechs. And so the ship that is headed from Europe towards Guatemala, the CIA is following it the whole way. And they are then able to show the world evidence that this guy has been under Soviet influence the whole time because he's bought weapons from Czech communists. And that is the kind of the only evidence that they have that says, okay, now we attack, right? Now we take him down.
This had horrible effect for Guatemala, didn't it? For the next 50 years. I mean, it wasn't just that they lost a president. They had civil war where they wouldn't have had civil war. And as I understand it, rural villagers were ethnic cleansing was actually in effect. They didn't call it ethnic cleansing, but many of the rural villagers were Aboriginal peoples or Indians.
That's true. I mean, partly you have to understand that Guatemala is different from most Central American nations. The ethnic groups have lived separately for far longer. And so by the 50s, you know, indigenous Guatemalans, many of whom didn't even speak Spanish, were probably 40-50%. They generally lived either landless or on small plots of land way high in the mountains. And one of the things that these two democratically elected presidents wanted to do, apart from giving land to some of them, was also just to integrate them more into Guatemalan society and government. So often it's just sort of like going out to the villages and saying like, okay, who lives here? What language do you speak? What do you guys need? Like, how about a hospital? How about a school? How about you participate in politics and we can have you vote and just become like a regular citizen? So there's a lot of initiatives like this, right? You know, and of course, yeah, you want them to eventually pay taxes. That's a way of integrating people into citizenship. And as soon as the coup happens in 1954, all of that comes to a screeching halt, right? And white Guatemalans are basically saying, to hell with that. Let's roll back all those reforms. They take all the land from the 100,000 families that had gotten land from Arbenz, give it back to the United Fruit Company and other rich farmers. And they say, that's it. These Indians are, you know, staying isolated in the mountains. The United States was then funneling money to these regimes, these sort of right-wing military regimes. And any indigenous community that got out of line at that point was treated like a hostile communist insurgent. And so, yeah, you had this sort of civil war begin, and it killed a couple of hundred thousand people by the 1980s. And so one of the real tragedies of the Cold War in Guatemala, and certainly the one that killed the most people in all of Cold War Latin America, in fact. By the early 80s, American policymakers were so dismayed by this and felt like, we don't even know what to do about this anymore. One of them actually said, what we would give to have another Arbenz right now, right? A peaceful, reformist, democratically elected, semi-socialist would be fine.
But they kept supporting the dictators.
They did, because it was the Cold War and it was the Reagan administration, right? I'm not saying all policymakers wanted this. Reagan was quite friendly to these folks. And it was up to really the end of the Cold War to bring peace to Guatemala, right? And so they finally, you know, wrote a peace agreement in the 1990s.
But, you know, that was more than 50 years.
I agree. That's exactly right.
And, I mean, it's a in a way, it's as shocking as what's happening in Israel. I'm not saying what's happening in Israel has to be stopped. It's evil. Well, what happened there was evil, and they let it happen for so long, and in some ways, it spread to the rest of Central America.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many differences between the two, but we have to also have to remember that the news was murkier back then, right? I mean, clearly Gaza, like, you know, there are a lot of journalists who are being kept out of Gaza, so a lot of information is not coming out. But most of the world has seen those images if they care to look. In Guatemala, there really weren't that many images. There really weren't that many journalists. This was happening often in the dead of night in faraway tiny villages, right? I mean, the massacre at El Mozote is a good example of this. It kills about 1,000 people in a, you know, it's just a genocide in a village. And it takes months for the rumors even to make it to the American embassy. And any American embassy is able to say, well, we don't have any evidence of this, you know, we'll go out and look and so on. And then they deny it. And it takes really a couple of years before there's any kind of acknowledgement by the U.S. government that, okay, something really, really bad did happen. And it was very likely done by the government or at least paramilitary forces. But it's like, it's much harder to tell back then because of the remoteness of the area.
Well, I think enough people knew they could have stopped it.
No, there's always somebody who knows and who can stop it, right? And certainly the Guatemalans. I mean, but even, I want to make it.
Even people in America who I suspect who were very political at the time and looked for things like that and knew to some extent because they wrote letters and they protested.
That's true. I think there was more known about El Salvador, about Nicaragua. Those were more U.S. supported. They're often in the cities, the things that were going on. But I want to make a larger point about sort of U.S. Latin American relations, which is that often we imagine that the Americans sort of know everything and are at fault for everything that Latin Americans do that is bad. And the problem with that is that it takes agency away from Latin Americans, right? It basically says, well, these are all a bunch of puppets in Latin America, the dictators, and the only bad people here are Americans. And that's simply not true. And the work of many, many historians is showing that increasingly. Often, you know, Americans might have known about things. They didn't necessarily participate in them. And so they certainly didn't initiate a lot of, you know, killings or genocides or disappearances. And so you have to kind of give agency to the people who actually conceived of and actually executed these things.
Wasn't an alliance between the American administration and the the wealthiest people in Latin America and the military.
I'm sorry, what's your question? What is the alliance?
Wasn't an unofficial alliance between the upper class Latin Americans and the CIA and the administration, and also the military class in Latin America?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, it's, I don't think they're meeting at a, there's no sort of large secret organization I've ever heard of. You know, the American government is a very complicated organization. It's not one organization. It doesn't move on the whim of sort of one person. It cannot keep large secrets. And so often, yeah, you might have meetings between very wealthy people in Latin America or Americans who have investments in Latin America, and then heads of foreign policy, right? Let's say Henry Kissinger or Richard Nixon. Sure, we know about those meetings. Does it mean that everybody in the State Department is on the same page, or everybody in the CIA is on the same page? I mean, the CIA's job or the State Department's job is not to protect American corporations, right? It's to help American citizens. It's to detect security issues. They're much more interested in security than they're interested in helping wealthy corporations. I mean, of course, that's their job also, because those are Americans and those are American interests. The CIA does not work for corporations. And I think most people who work for the CIA, if you told them that, they would just laugh at you and say,
You were talking about agency later, and the wealthy minority in Latin America had agency. And part of their agency was seeking help from American military and from the CIA and from the American government.
Yeah, and I think most of the time they did it through their own sort of military leaders, right? So more often you would have a meeting between somebody like Henry Kissinger and a military leader. And then the military leader had to go back to his country and say, all right, all the rich people of Chile or Argentina or Brazil, what do you guys want? You know, how can we, you know, there was an alliance there. But I mean, rarely have I seen a meeting between heads of American foreign policy and heads of Latin American corporations.
No, that's not what.
There are people between them.
It's what I see is there was an unofficial, they had the same goals in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, just think of the goal of anti-communism, right? Of course, Kissinger and Nixon want communism gone from the Americas. And of course, you know, large corporations hate communists because communists help workers organize.
But they considered anybody who opposed them as communists. I mean, some of them may have been.
Yeah. Some of them certainly may have been.
But
it depends.
You were opposed because you wanted to help the landless, or you supported a democratic government. You weren't necessarily opposed because you were a communist. You were opposed because you were called a communist.
Yeah, I think that's true in most cases. I mean, at some point by the 1970s, this comes to be called the National Security Doctrine, right? Which is essentially the way that Latin American military regimes in South America started thinking of their opponents, which is basically saying anyone who opposes me in any way, peaceful or violent, whatever their intentions are, if they oppose me, then I treat them as insurgents. I treat them as if they were armed, as if they were ready to attack the state to overthrow it. And so, of course, what do you do with people like that? You jail them, right? You torture them. You disappear them. And so it was a real important sort of qualitative change in how Latin Americans thought about security. And again, an interesting agency question is, you know, how do they come up with this theory? I mean, they're certainly being trained by Americans to hate communism and to, you know, fight against communism in all sorts of ways. Are the Americans telling them, jail all your opponents, disappear tens of thousands of them? We don't really have the evidence of that.
What about the School of the Americas?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I mean. There were instances of that. I think at the School of the Americas, leaders who wanted to jail all their opponents basically got the message from American trainers, that they would look the other way if that happened.
And they also learned how to do certain things.
Perhaps. That's right. They would learn, you know, I mean, yes, there were potentially kind of torture manuals and that sort of thing. You know, doesn't mean that they were widespread or systematically used.
Actually, they were systematically and widely used. Maybe not by the CIA, but by the people who became dictators.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Once the dictators left the School of the Americas, they basically said, okay, this is what the Americans are going to let us do, right? Which is essentially eliminate all our political opponents, torture them. They're going to look the other way. And we have meetings at which, you know, Kissinger would essentially say this to, you know, the Argentine foreign minister, for instance. There's a meeting, I think, in 1976 where the Argentine says, well, you know, we have all these terrorists who are causing us this trouble, all these communist terrorists, and we have to take care of them. So your talk of human rights is not helping us. And Kissinger basically says, well, you know, that's for public consumption. We understand that you're dealing with terrorists and you need to deal with that issue very quickly and as quietly as possible, right? So they're getting the green light, right? But to say that Kissinger is ordering them to do these things.
Well, he didn't need to order them to do them.
I'm sorry?
He didn't need to order them to do them to be responsible.
I understand, but there's a difference between saying the United States is making these countries into military dictatorships.
No, they allowed them to become.
Yes. Oh, very
And in the case of Chile, they made it into a military dictatorship. And some. And a lot of Central American countries to some extent.
Yeah, they certainly helped a lot. I mean, they certainly wanted to have the overthrow or the end of the government of Allende, who was an elected socialist. And so when the coup happens, the Americans are delighted. They don't plan
on
the coup.
They also help destabilize it economically and otherwise.
Exactly, exactly. And so when the coup happens, yeah, they're happy and they've done their part. But their part has not included planning or, you know, or helping with the actual coup. They just sort of, they mostly help afterwards.
Some of this came to light earlier than it might have because of liberation theology, especially in El Salvador. I mean,
that's true.
In El Salvador, a lot of the opposition was actually ended up being, or the archbishop tried to preach peace and tried to end the civil war. And a lot of the priests and sisters believed in land reform, believed in liberation of people from the perspective of the New Testament.
Yeah.
And they paid for it.
It tells you something about how bad conditions were by the 1960s and 70s, how many landless people there were, how many sort of hungry people there were, especially in Central America, and how repressed they were by their governments whenever they spoke up. That, you know, the priests who were traditionally in Latin America, the ones who told folks, don't rock the boat, right? Live a simple life of suffering and you'll be rewarded in the afterlife. And all of a sudden, they're saying, never mind that. You got to start struggling because God actually, Jesus actually is a revolutionary and God loves the poor. And we are going to start as a church to try to, you know, have a preferential option for the poor. And Archbishop Romero is, you know, this sort of trickles up to him. And like he's not actually.
He was actually, you know, a conservative in the beginning.
Exactly, right. He's just seeing sort of the suffering and he starts telling, right, the military leaders of El Salvador, can you take your foot off the gas here in terms of repressing these poor peasants? And he gets assassinated for it.
Along with quite a few other Catholics.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, a lot of these are in other Central American countries. Some of these are Americans.
It's interesting that the present pope was a bishop in Peru for a long time. This was after this.
Right. Yeah, I'm not familiar enough with Latin American religion to know where liberation theology is now, but I think, you know, from my direct experience, it still impacts a lot of priests in Latin America. Catholicism is less powerful, less prevalent than it used to be. But I mean, if I've been in some churches where it's pretty amazing how, you know, how close to the people the priests are, how they talk about the ordinary things that are happening in the parish. They try to help the poor. They try to sort of organize people. And so I think the legacy of liberation theology is still pretty powerful all over the continent.
So there's some good news still around.
Yeah. But then, of course, you have, you know, archbishops here and there who are mouthpieces for repressive right-wing governments.
Sure. Getting to the present time, how do you think the majority of Latin Americans feel about Trump's pushing regime change in Venezuela and his bombing of boats offshore of Venezuela, which may be drug smugglers or may be just fishing boats, with very little to tell the difference once they're sunk?
Yeah.
And unleashing the CIA. How do people feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of reliable polls yet. I mean, there certainly aren't on Venezuelans, right? Because you just can't poll the Venezuelan people now. They live in a repressive country. They know that security is watching them all the time. Once in a while, somebody in the street will say something that's anti-Maduro, but sometimes they'll have somebody come up and say, hey, don't say that. So yeah, Venezuela, you can't trust. Other Latin Americans, I would think the majority of people both don't want Maduro in power.
Yeah.
And at the same time would oppose an American intervention to take Maduro out of power. I mean, if there were, for instance, a shift or a rift in the military and part of the military overthrew the other part and then took down Maduro, I think most Latin Americans would be delighted by that, including most Latin American leaders. Now, they would probably want it as sort of orderly and peaceful as possible, because what they don't want is millions of Venezuelans, fanning out throughout the continent, especially in places like Colombia. So I'm not sure the Colombians really want, you know, the overthrow of Maduro. But yeah, it's hard to tell. I don't think we have very good polls so far.
Does a country like a big country like Russia or the United States, they have a right to overthrow and bring about regime change in with leaders that they don't agree with and who they may consider corrupt or in some way unethical from their perspective? Does that give them the right to invade or to overthrow?
No. There is no right in any international legal context to overthrow a sovereign government that has not threatened you or attacked you. I mean, I'm not an international lawyer, but I'm pretty sure that's the state of things. Even if the United Nations, let's say, would vote a resolution, right, to sort of take down Maduro, still wouldn't be legal. There's a pretty clear principle in international relations, which is the ultimate sovereignty of nations, right? It's the Westphalian principle. And you just can't overthrow a foreign nation unless it has attacked you or unless it's threatening to attack you. And they just can't show that. I mean, it's interesting that they're almost trying to make that justification. And this is the weird chain. So they say that the president of the country is not legally elected, and that he's the head of a drug organization, and that drug organization is sending drugs to the United States, and that therefore it is a terrorist organization, and that therefore this is an act of insurrection or an intervention into the United States, and therefore they're defending themselves.
Did that work very well in Iraq? I mean, is the Middle East better off because of what they did?
Tough question to answer. I mean, maybe Iraq might be better, right? Rid of a dictatorship. But
I mean,
the Middle
you've
East
had chaos in the Middle East ever since. I mean, they certainly didn't lessen the chaos in the Middle East.
No, that's true. I mean, dictators tend to not create chaos, right? They tend to create order. And so you've certainly had a much emboldened Iran. But I mean, it's already been 20 some years since the war in Iraq began and Saddam Hussein's been out of power. But yeah, you've had ISIS, you've had a war in Syria, you've had the growth of Iran and its allies throughout the Middle East. So yeah, you could call these unintended consequences, but you could also call them pretty obvious consequences of taking out of power Iran's biggest, adversary, is that you make Iran more powerful.
What do you think of Admiral Alvin Hosley? He retired 2 years before he had to. He went down a step from four-star admiral to three-star. Why do you think he
Well,
did this?
there's additional evidence, there's additional news on that lately, in that, when we first talked about this, there was really absolutely no public word on why he left, right? He might have left for whatever, there are personal reasons or something. But now we know that he left after those first boat strikes in early September. And there are reports. I can't verify them, but there are reports that he did so because he disagreed with those attacks. He thought they were illegal, and he was getting clear signals from the Secretary of Defense that if you're not on board with shooting these boats out of the water and acts of war, not acts of war, war crimes, then you shouldn't be in charge of Southern Command, right? Because it's Southern Command that's doing this. So we don't have all the details, but that seems to be the story that's emerging, in fact, just today.
Okay, thank you very much. We're talking with Professor Alan McPherson about the American record in Latin America. And it's been a very useful conversation. And thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.